Okay, everyone. It's already on my computer, 8:31, and more people are logging in, but we have to start. I see even the name of someone who sent me an interesting email. He wants to know when we're done this series will take us a while. He wants to know if we can do a talk on, he says, I notice from time to time you refer to interesting, obscure, or controversial svarim, which you have been able to acquire, and many of them seem to have quite a story behind them. Maybe a series on sensational svarim. So okay, but we got a ways here because we're only one third of the book way through. Okay, a couple of things before we begin, and today is going to be focused a good deal on history, especially you'll see in a minute. I just want to pick up, follow up on a couple of things we said last time. If anyone's interested in Reb Mazuz's new Parsha sheet, he returns to the coffee issue. There must have been some pushback, and now he says if you want to make the bracha on it, you can, although he still says if you just drink it black. Apparently some people are interested in coffee. A number of people were very fascinated by what I showed you last class, the joint prayer, interfaith prayer, whatever you want to call it. One of you who's listening now wrote to me that it's a shanda. But I want to read you the actual text of the prayer. They all read the same thing, some of it. God of the first and of the last, God of all creatures, Lord of all generations, he arouses those who sleep and awakens those who slumber. He heals the sick, opens the eyes of the blind, raises those who are bowed down, etc., etc. Hundreds of thousands have died, millions have fallen sick. Save, we beseech thee, O Lord. We entreat thee, O Lord, send prosperity. It's a joint prayer. There's no question about it. It's an interfaith prayer. So I said that this is unique. I've never heard of this. And it's, and most people would agree. However, Alon Goshen Gottstein emailed me. It's not actually unique. There was something else similar to that a week prior. And let me show you. Here you can see it. The same sort of thing with the Chief Rabbi Amar and Rabbi Aryeh Stern of Chief Rabbi of Jerusalem. Maybe it's a little different because it says in this event, each one of the leaders said a prayer aloud to the others. I'm not sure whether because I don't see a video, whether they told the Christians not to say Jesus. And then they each prayed a silent prayer together. It says according to their own tradition. So that's a little different. It's Jews, Christians, and Muslims together, each praying their own prayer, but it's a joint prayer. It's interfaith joint prayer. Nothing that when I told Alon Goshen Gottstein that, because he didn't believe me, but I said to him, I guarantee you, I said, this is something that in America is completely impossible. There's no way you'd have rabbis getting together with priests and Muslims to do joint prayers. It just is. It's so foreign. But there you have it. We'll see. I still don't know, and Alon doesn't know either, what exactly convinced the chief rabbis that this was something to do. The other thing I want to get to before we begin, because I mentioned it, and a lot of you, I don't think knew what I was referring to. We're going to be picking up in a second, in a minute, I should say, a couple of minutes, with Rabbi Avinair's letter, and we're dealing with, respecting sages if they have a different viewpoint. And for somehow we got into the discussion of Rabbi Tendler, and I mentioned that Rabbi Tendler, I mean, he takes this very seriously, and he responds very sharply when he, in all areas. That's just his personality. I want to now show you an example from Rabbi Tengler, which really plays into exactly what we were discussing. And I lived through this because it relates to the funeral of Rabbi Soloveitchik. So let me, there were probably some of you who were from Boston who were there. I was at the funeral. Rabbi Soloveitchik died on Erev Shabbos. It was the 9th of April, 93. But since it was Friday, there was the burial and the funeral and the burial was on Sunday. Now, Sunday was Erev Yom Tov, the last days. So many people came. YU chartered a plane. People came up. And yet there were people who could not make it there. For example, the Feinsteins, they couldn't get there, I guess, before Yom. So they would come there after the Shiva. There was an event at YU. So I think both Rebovit and Reuven Feinstein were there and others. However, there were also those who refused to come. There was an actual boycott, which apparently came out of Philadelphia, not to go to the funeral. Now, this was all covered in the Allgemeiner Journal. The Allgemeiner Journal doesn't exist anymore other than the online version, which is just a very good site to find out. It's all English to find out Israel news. But the Allgemeiner Journal used to be Yiddish, and then it became Yiddish and English. And I was learning Yiddish at the time, so I would buy it every week at the Israel Bookshop in Brookline. But the English section was more interesting because it was like a... It was a mix of Chabad, modern orthodoxy, and they covered all of this. And they covered, unfortunately, I never saved copies of the newspaper articles, all these. They're not, I looked at Harvard. Harvard does not have those. The only place probably get them is at the Allgemeiner offices because it's not online. But they covered the whole dispute over the Rav's funeral, the boycott. Not only did they cover it, they even printed a letter from some guy explaining why they didn't go to the funeral and it was not appropriate not to go to the funeral. Everyone was outraged, but Mrs. Tversky said, I remember, she said she doesn't understand the big deal. They didn't respect her father in his lifetime. Why should they respect him afterwards? And then Rav Aaron Soloveitchik wrote a piece, a long piece, in which he attacked this person and explained who the Rav was. This is a very important historical document. For some reason, I never saved it. I wrote today to Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik in Israel, that's Rav Aaron's son. He doesn't have a copy. I wrote to his brother, Rav Yosef Soloveitchik, who I hope has a copy. His brother is the one who put out the volume on Rav Aaron, the two volumes with all the historical documents. I can maybe speak about that book another time. It's an incredible book because he publishes all the documents, even the stuff attacking his father. It's a very interesting, important document dealing with the disputes in Skokie, etc. But maybe he has it. I hope someone has it because it's, as I said, it really puts for Varon, although at the funeral, he said he's not going to talk about the issues. He did end up criticizing the right wing, although he said that if I was in their place, maybe I would have done the same. You can even hear it online. They have an audio on the YU Torah website. But in the article, he really goes to town attacking figures who don't show respect to his brother. Okay, so that's immediately after the funeral. And then there was the issue after that of the Jewish Observer. That's the official publication of the Aguda. Now, the Aguda is going to have to say something about the passing of Soloveitchik. The same problem they're going to have with this, they're going to have with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who dies shortly after that. So they publish a little article, which I'll show you in a second. And then Rabbi Tendler, who was a Talmud, a big Talmuder of Soloveitchik from the early years, was outraged. And I'm going to show you what he says. It's relevant also because the very issue we discussed last week, if you... disrespect the sage. If you degrade a sage, although I don't think this is degrading what we're going to see, it's disrespecting. We saw what halacha is in the Rambam. Now, I also didn't save this, unfortunately. I don't know why I didn't save this. Fortunately, someone actually put it online, and even there's a link to it. If you go to Rabbi Soloveitchik's Wikipedia page, there's a link to it. That's the way I was able to locate it. Now I'm more careful. I save all these sorts of things. It's very easy to save it now. You just make a PDF. But I want to show you now the... I want to show you quickly what he wrote. Okay. So let me enlarge it here. Here's the review, the eulogy. We don't need to look at the eulogy per se. We'll see what Rav Moshe Tendler says, but already you see it's Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik Zichrono Livracha. We know in that world, in the Haredi world, everyone gets Harav, Gaon, et cetera, et cetera. He only gets a Zal. Zion Lamed. That everyone gets that. No Zatzal, no. So where do you publish if you want to publish an attack on the Jewish Observer? You publish it in the Allgemeiner, which loved to cover this thing. Now, I have to say that Rabbi Tendler's response is way over the top, and I don't think it's really appropriate. But it's an interesting historical document, and only... this year, did something come out relevant to this? So I can send this to if anyone wants to. I mean, he says in the second paragraph, Well, he identifies himself. Why did you permit N. Wolpin, who was passed away last year, to soil the pages of your official publication with the denigration of the greatest Rosh Hashiva of our generation? That's Rabbi Nissen Wolpin. And then he quotes the Gemara, which we mentioned last week. The Talmud gives the following definition of an apikoros. Who is it? One who degrades a scholar. That's the exact question I asked Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. How are you supposed to treat these rabbis who degrade Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Cook? That was the issue I wrote to Rav Henkin about. That's the issue that we're in the same discussion with Rabbi Avinir that we'll get to in a minute. Rav Henkin's attitude was also like Rav Aaron Soloveitchik today. What are you going to do? You can't put everyone in a chayrim. Rabbi Tendler takes, he uses this Gemara. As I said last week, people will use it when they want to. And he uses it and he goes and he does. I mean, there's no question that what he says is correct. Although I said it goes over the top because granted that they're not giving the Rav the respect he deserves, but that doesn't mean that they're degrading him or tearing him down. I think actually the worst thing they said is as follows, when in the article they write, here it is. Where is it? First column. When his father, Ramosha, passed away in 1941, he succeeded him as Rosh Hashiva in Yeshivas Rabbi Yisrael Chanan, where he had profound impact on the thousands of young men who passed through his classes. That's when he passed through his classes. They're trying to turn him into a professor, not into a Gadol Bisrael giving shiurim. So, of course, Rabbi Tendler picks up on this. The snide remark, students who passed through his classes, tries to portray a professor-student relationship, not a Rebbe Talmud bonding. No one ever passed through the Rav's classes. The fire of Sinai burns so brightly, etc., etc. And look in F, the evil in Wolpin's heart finds clearest expression. He goes on and on. So that's the article. It's both the eulogy, if you want to call it that, of the Jewish Observer. Look, they had to say something. But on the other hand, what could they say? In the right-wing world, it's very strange because they have a hard problem praising people who are to their left. They have no problem because you're going to say, well, it's against Das Torah. But it's more simple. It's not so simple because the Satmar Rebbe is also not in accord with Das Torah. Das Torah means the Lithuanian Das Torah. And yet they recognize he's not, but they still respect him and give him the kavod. But when, to the left, there they have a very difficult problem. They can't recognize that. They're afraid, I guess, people will start looking at Rabbi Soloveitchik as a great Torah scholar. Let me end with one thing. And as I said, you'll have the same issue later with the Lubavitch Rebbe. So Rabbi Tendler portrays him as terrible apikoros for dealing with the Rav that way. Everyone was disappointed, and go as far as Rabbi Tendler, very disappointed in the YU world, especially the right-wing YU people, because they thought that at the end here, at least they show respect to Rabbi Soloveitchik, which they didn't. What no one knows, well, I'll tell you, now you'll know, but only became apparent in the last year, this book came out. It's called Sarat Esh. It's by one of the close confidants of Rav Shach. Now, after the information that's in this, I think we have to give the Jewish Observer a lot of credit, believe it or not. Because if you open up, because who was the Gadol then? The Gadol was Rav Shach. And he was determining policy. If you look in this book, I'm going to write about this in the future blog post, on page 475, he tells us that when Rabbi Soloveitchik died, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, Shelo ha'yeruach chachamim nochayim, I knew that the great rabbis didn't approve of Rabbi Soloveitchik. I hate to say it, these great rabbis who didn't approve of him, leaving aside Rav Shach, who didn't approve of him, but he was a really great one. All the other great rabbis, you could put them on one side and put Rabbi Soloveitchik on the other, and it's not even a comparison. And they're all forgotten, and Rabbi Soloveitchik, of course, lives on. Rav Shach was more substantial. I think there's also a personal dilemma with Rav Shach. Rav Shach's son ended up leaving Israel and going to YU, where he studied for a degree at Bernard Revel. So there was a personal thing that his son did not follow in the yeshiva path. So maybe he blamed YU. But what does it say here? Horel orchei chanim charedim shelo yizkiru otokal. Rav Shach ordered that the Haredi newspapers not mention Rav Soloveitchik's passing at all. And therefore in Yatei Ne'eman and all these places, you won't have any example of this. It goes further. I hate to say it, but I'll read it. They asked Rorschach, is it possible to at least just print a note that the grandson of Reb Chaim died without praising him? And then he answers, Reb Chaim shep zichmitim. Reb Chaim is ashamed of him. And then it says that in Jerusalem, his students and the Briskers, the Soloveitchiks in Jerusalem, organized a hesped for him. Because the Soloveitchiks in Jerusalem, although they had different hashkafa, they had a great lot of respect for him. So this is the Briskerov's family. They're the more extreme Rorschach. They're anti-Zionist, etc. And it says he got very angry that they did this, and that he got very angry at one of the members of the Briskerov's family who said, "Well, it's mishpacha." When you read this, now you understand what happened. The Jewish Observer did something. The Agudas Yisrael of America did something which is almost unheard of. They refused to listen to the Das Torah of Rorschach. Because Rorschach said, don't put anything in. When you look at it that way, I think you have to see that they were doing the most they thought they could do under the circumstances. But it's an unbelievably brave act of Rabbi Wolpin in his world to say that I'm not going to listen to Rorschach and we have to write something. So when you see it this way, I think it comes out very different than we thought for all these years. We're not happy. I don't think anyone can be happy looking at the eulogy, but unless you think it better to have nothing, which I don't believe, and subsequently in the Haredi world, they become much more open to Rav Soloveitchik. There's a whole thing in Mishpacha with Rav Schechter, and you have Rabbi Meiselman's yeshiva, which is not just in the Haredi world, they're with the Peleg. So, granted, they reinterpret the Rav their way, but at least his name is no longer Pasul. So, I think... I hope you find that interesting. Okay, let us now pick up where we were. We're in the middle of the letter on page. If you have the book in front of you, page 125 from Rabbi Aviner. Just to show you Rabbi Aviner again. Aviner, the interesting person in many ways. There he is. He's really, there's two sides to him. On the one hand, he has a very gentle side and one who appeals to lots of people. On the other hand, he says some very extreme things. And he's explained, well, I'm saying it for those who listen to. He has children. Of his nine children, five of them are not in the religious community anymore. And apparently they claim it's because he was very open-minded, didn't try to indoctrinate them. So the whole thing is, it's a really interesting person, and he has a lot of interesting things to say, even if you can't accept them. I mean, some of them are just are a little bit too extreme, I think. Now I want to, okay, so let me stop sharing this now. If you recall, the first paragraph is Rav Aviner made the case even stronger than Rabbi Henkin, that we have to respect all Gedolim, all great Torah scholars, not just Gedolim, Torah scholars. If they say something that degrades one of our sages, we have to rebuke them, but you still have to respect them. You can't respond in kind, as we saw Rabbi Tendler did, which is what the Gemara says to do. He says that you can't, and later on he's going to explain, just like Rabbi Rav Zaharan Soloveitchik and Rabbi Henkin, that if you do that, everything will collapse, so we won't have any peace. So then I asked him the following question. I said, I got it. This is where we ended the last question. And this will take us into history as well. I received your letter, and I'm still confused. How can we respect people, even Talmidei Chachamim, who defame, degrade Gedolei Yisrael? It's known that there are Talmidei Chachamim who degrade Rav Kook, and then I cite a book, L'Hilchot Sibur, page 118, and I'll tell you in a minute why I cited that, and he's going to respond to this. And then I said, certainly Rav Yehuda Cook, the son of Rav Kook, his Rebbe, Rav Aviner's Rebbe, didn't respect him to Rekata and Satmar, who degraded his father and other Gedolim. Okay. So I said, see this book, L'Hilchot Sibur. L'Hilchot Sibur is with Rav Yehuda Cook, and it's his public declarations over many years. What I said... And I thank Shmuel from Ottawa for emailing me. I can't see your letter email here. But Shmuel, I said that Ratzvi Yehuda Cook is probably the first one to use the term Hochot Sibor the way he does. The phrase actually appears, if you look in the Gemara in Shabbos, Kuf Lamed Tes Lamed Aleph, it says, Marzutra says, Ebo Tamidei Chachamim Shemalamdim Hochot Sibor, Ladainai Bor, that it says, it uses the phrase that Tamidei Chachamim are those who teach Hochot Sibor to ignorant Dayanim, judges. So what does Hilchot Sibor mean? I'm holding a Sansino in front of me. It says the laws of the public. And in their note there, probably laws concerning communal matters, the imposts for levies, for communal and charitable purposes. Just matters that concern communal things. And I guess that's what it means. But I looked at Otzer Chachma, no one ever cites it. And when they cite it, they'll maybe speak about in a community, if you have to set up a tzedakah, that sort of thing. No one uses it like Ratzvi Yehuda uses it, meaning everything, giving back land, matters of men and women, Bnei Akiva, all these sorts of things, these wide-ranging issues. That's, as far as I know, Ratzvi Yehuda is really the first to use it. Shmuel called my attention to... Actually, the title page of Rav Chaim Hirschenson's commentary on Horayot. We've had classes on Rav Chaim Hirschenson. If you go to the Torah in Motion website, and it's a very interesting commentary. And I had forgotten on the title page itself. He says he's explaining all these matters, Nasi, Kohen Mashiach, Hilchot, that all this is valuable for those Talmidei Chachamim who are learning Hilchot Sibor. He also uses it, but he's all referring to the political. He was very concerned about the future establishment of a state for the Jews, and you have to run it. You need, how are you going to run the parliament, etc. Ratzvi Yehuda is much more wide-ranging. So that's the book, Hilchot Sibor. I just was looking online earlier today, and I saw a good example of this by an article from the late Rabbi Rosen from the Tzomet Institute. He used an expression which Rav Avram Shapiro said. During the withdrawal from Gaza, you had all these people making comments, coming out with statements, they should have to listen to the government, et cetera, et cetera. And at the time, Rav Avram Shapiro said, not every rebel, it means like a little Rebbe, but it's a derogatory thing, is able to paskin in Hilchot Sibor. That is, matters that deal with the Jewish community as a whole, these are not local, these are not like your little matters. And in this article, Rabbi Rosen, he distinguishes between small matters. You ask a question to your local rabbi versus, where's the example he gives? Hilchot Sibor, he says, Datu Medina, Shelot Refuah, there's brain death. Kashrut, ethics, Ma'amad Eisha, Medinyot Binlumit, international affairs, Kalkala, the economy, Bitachon, et cetera, et cetera. These are things that the big things you can't ask. Little rabbis don't decide these things. Sometimes rabbis have this conception. They got their cloth and now they can decide anything. They can paskin. Yeah, you can paskin. You can tell the local person, do you do this or that on Shabbos in his house? How to heat up the tea or whatever? But on matters affecting the Jewish people as a whole, those are Hilchot Sibor. I think even these Corona tshuvot are because when the rabbi gives the tshuva, the big rabbi, it affects all of our lives and it's Sakonas Nefashos. So that's Hilchot Sibor. Now I'm going to tell you what appears. When I said to in my letter to Rabbi Avinair, I said that there were Talmidei Chachamim who degraded Rav Kook, and I told him to see this book, page 118, and if you look in this book, you'll see differently than Rav Avinair says. You'll see Ratzvi Yehuda comes out very negatively and degrades those who degraded his father. So before I explain this, I need to give you a bit of history. Incidentally, he mentions the Ratzvi Yehuda is going to mention that in Masechet Tainit, it says you can call an insolent person a Rasha. Let me tell you the history. Those who heard the classes that are in Rishizal Meltzer, you know this or you remember it perhaps, but I have to repeat it. We have a lot of new people as well. Well, actually, before I even say it, a little bit of background. The Agudas Yisrael. Agudas Yisro in Europe was an organization composed of many different types of rabbis, those who were close to Eretz Yisrael, believed in settling, and not Zionists, but close, pretty close, including anti-Zionists, and they encompassed pretty much all of Poland Orthodoxy, pretty much, not all of them. There was Mizrahi, but for example, the Gera Rebbe, and it was a very important organization. However, in Eretz Yisrael, the branch of Agudas Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael was what is known as the Eda Charedit, Rav Zonnenfeld and later of Dushinsky. And the Eda Charedit, this group, always had a very big extremist segment. When I say an extremist, I mean the most terrible things said about Rav Kook and Rav Tzipias HaFrank and others. And the rabbis in Europe didn't know what to do with it. And it got so bad when the Lubavitch Rebbe went to Israel and met with Rav Kook, they put up signs against him. When the Gera Rebbe went, they put up terrible things. They didn't know what to do about them. What happened over the years was that as more and more people from Germany and from Poland went to Eretz Yisrael and they saw these fanatics, they wanted nothing to do with them. And this then led to a break. And Agudas Yisrael decides to go to be part of the state. And the old Agudas Yisrael, which was the Aguda in Eretz Yisrael, the old Yishuv, they become the Eda Charedit, which then has different branches, they did the Trikarta, etc. But you have this strange situation where Agudas Yisrael, which is like a mainstream organization, their branch in the land of Israel, which had great Torah scholars, but was also had, including it, all sorts of fanatics and irresponsible people. They were sending out newsletters to Europe. They're called Seiri Agudas Yisrael, a number of them, the youngsters, these hotheads. They were involved with the Diskin Orphanage with the most unbelievable disparagement and degrading of Torah sages. And the Aguda in Eretz Yisrael couldn't do anything about it. Why? Because it was very incestuous. They all were related to each other. And they were afraid. Well, first of all, they were related, so they had these family ties, but they also were afraid if they throw these people out, then they're going to come after them. It's very similar to the Democrats today and Ilhan Omar. We all know that they could not even come together to condemn anything she said in her anti-Semitic statement. It's always hard to condemn people who are in your group. So they remained part of Agudas Yisrael, and this is the history. If they ever write an honest history of Agudas Yisrael, they have to deal with this, that this was part of the Agudas, of the Aguda. In 1932, Shushan Purim, a group of these Seirei Agudas Yisrael, so you're talking about people 15, 16, 17, 18, but young people, hotheads, they weren't only young, sometimes they got older, they also remained this way. Amram Blau from the Trikarta is part of this, is in the Aguda. A group of Seirei Agudas Yisrael members meet at a show in Jerusalem, it's in the area of Batei Broida, it's called, for a masiva, a Purim feast. And one of the things that happened there, and people had been invited to it, there were ads, signs put up, that they were going to do a court case, a Psakdin, called, and this is the name of the play they were putting on, Psakdin, like Sanata de Avodah Zarah of Amizraim. They're putting on something about Avodah Zarah. I don't know, what does that mean? It's going to be a play. Well, it turns out that at this play, they have the Baistin and Rav Kook has a part. Rav Kook is put on trial for his heresy and idolatry. And in the end, Rav Kook is sentenced to death. And the sentence is carried out and he is shot. Because he can't, we don't have, I guess, Dalad Misos Baistin anymore. So instead you have to kill him some other way. So he's actually shot. They got a fake gun and Rav Kook, and they shoot him. The response to this was severe. In Europe, when they heard about this, they didn't know what to do. People saw this as an indictment of Agudas Yisrael in Jerusalem, and the assumption was that the young people doing this were just expressing the views of their parents. And this was seen as just a continuation of what Agudas Yisrael as a whole in Jerusalem, extremists who were part of Agudas Yisrael, were doing to Rav Kook. The Aguda leaders in Germany and Warsaw were furious. Kollel in Poland, Warsaw, the Kollel, the people who were supported, who had come, they even if they weren't supported, they were associated with Poland, they were Gera Hasidim, associated with Poland. They publicly identified with Rav Kook and invited him to speak to them. And that was really the beginning of the end of Agudas Yisrael as a unified group, because all these Gera Hasidim started giving their alliance to Rav Kook. Now, who was front and center of, I'll get to this in a second, actually. 2 months after this, Rav Eliyahu Klatskin, the Lubliner Rav, I shouldn't call him the Lubliner Rav. He had been in Lublin. He was in Mariampol, actually. Mariampol, the Lubliner Rav, we speak of Mayor Shapiro. Mariampol, remember we spoke the other day about names that have Christian terms to them? We saw Calavera, Calvary, but Calvary, but Mariampol was named after Mary. And no one had a problem referring to that. He died, and Rav Kook was set to deliver a hesped. The same crazies prevented the coffin of Rav Klatskin, who was had connections to the Eda Haredi, from being brought into the courtyard of the Etz Chaim Yeshiva. Now, after the trial of Rav Kook, as it were, Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer and Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein published the following letter. You can see it in many places, in which they write to Rav Kook and they say, you should not be concerned that they were pogea in your kavod. The disgrace is only for them who did this. We are just, we're distressed by the great Hefkeros, it says, shall be Isra Bizeon Torah, the Talmidei Chachamim, etc., etc. And he says, we can only be comforted that this was done by Tzirin, who are not responsible for their actions. Nevertheless, Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer used to daven at the Shul, where this event took place. And when the Shul refused to take action against the people involved in the trial, he stopped davening there. Among the people involved in this was this man. I don't know if any of you, here he is. Menachem Porush. Hold on. If you read the Jewish press, he used to have a column. He was a member of Knesset from 1959 to 1994. And so what was his role in this? He published, he gave an interview towards the end of his life. You can see the link if you go to the Hebrew Wikipedia page of Menachem Porush. He has a whole interview and asks about this because it's famous. And he says, Lo Yariti Barav Kook, because the story is that he was the one who fired the bullets, who killed Rav Kook. And he says, however, he says that it's not true. He says he came to see the show, and as soon as he came in, they started the trial against Rav Kook. Three judges, in quotes, were sitting there. One of them was my relative, Shlomo Zalman Porush. When they saw me, they said, I should be Rav Kook. So the way he tells the story, he was Rav Kook, and they took the gun, and then they shot him. And he says, I didn't know what was going on. They come in, they make me Rav Kook, and then they shoot me. But the story is, and then he says that this has followed him, he says, his entire life. Here's his language. He says that the people twisted it. He says, I never did this. And he says in here, this is something that's... that's his whole life has followed him. Actually, that's the article. It says, Yeshut Parsha Achat, Asher Rodefet et Porush Kol Yamo. Because everyone knows that it was Porush who shot Rav Kook. He says it wasn't, but everyone knows it is. When I say knows in quotations. I don't think anyone in the Eda Haredit ever denied it was him. I can't tell you whether he told the truth, whether he didn't. He obviously had reason to not tell the truth. Okay, that's the story. So now I can read you what appears in Hilchot Sibur. So you can appreciate what I asked Rav Avinir. And if Rav Avinir is saying we have to respect all the Gedolim, what about what we're going to see where Tzvi Yehuda said? Even before I get to that, I want to read you something else. In this book of Tzvi Yehuda Kook, L'Nitzivot Yisrael, it has a letter here written to Rav Yitzchak Meir Levin, Rav Itcha Meir Levin. Itcha Meir Levin was the brother-in-law of the Ger Rebbe. He's a signer of the Israeli Declaration of Independence. He was really the leader of Agudas Yisrael. The Ger Rebbe dies in 1948. You can see his grave. It's not far from Machane Yehuda. But Itcha Meir Levin, more than anyone else, is responsible for bringing the Agudas Yisrael into the Israeli government. He was the first minister. In fact, after him, there wasn't an Israeli minister until Litzman, who is with us now. He was his first minister. He was first minister of health. Wasn't such a good minister of health. He apparently didn't follow all the rules himself. And that was a big deal because the Aguda, after Levin, refused to have a minister. So now they have a new policy. They believe in having ministers. Itamar Levin was responsible more than anyone for bringing the Aguda into the Israeli government, agreeing to go along with it, to be part of the state. He signed a Declaration of Independence. His attitude always was, you know, we served in Warsaw. I think he was in the Polish parliament. We could be in the Polish parliament. Certainly, the Jewish parliament is not worse than the Polish parliament. It might not be better, he thinks, but it's certainly not worse. And he did think it was better. And in the fights in the 40s about whether there should be a state, the Aguda should support a state, you had Yaakov Rosenheim in America saying no to a state. They were terrified that as soon as the state of Israel was declared, the secularists would force all the religious kids into secular schools. And therefore, they didn't want a state. When they knew a state was coming, Rosenheim said, well, let's have Jerusalem remain independent. This also has to be part of this history of Aguda. Aguda, one part of it, the American branch, opposed the state, but Richard Mayer Levin supported the state. And you can look in Fuld's book on Aguda's historical politics during the mandatory period. There are letters. He got access to the Aguda archives, strong letters from Levin telling Rosenheim to stop this. Who gives Rosenheim the authority to talk? The Agudas Yisrael is supposed to be led by the Moatzes Gedolei Torah. And after World War II, the only Moatzes Gedolei Torah was in the land of Israel. So how can Rosenheim, who's a Baal HaBos, he's not even a rabbi. You look around, people talk about Rosenheim, they always refer to him as Rabbi Rosenheim. He's a Baal HaBos. So what does he get to go in front of the Anglo-American Commission, you know, say whatever he says and other things? So Richard Mayer Levin, Zionists should look very fondly upon Itamar Levin because he was Aguda could have gone a different way. So he invites, this is a letter in 1954, they were going to have an Aguda convention in Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Itamar Levin invites Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook to come to the convention. Why not? Rav Tzvi Yehuda is a Rosh Hashiva. Remember his father, Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, was invited to come to the convention that was supposed to be in Frankfurt in 1914. Rav Cook arrives in Germany, and shortly after that, World War I breaks out. Rav Cook is stranded. He makes his way to Switzerland, where he's 2 years, and then he goes to London, where he's the Rav Machzik Yadas. So there was a long connection between the Cook family and Agudas Yisrael in Europe, that is. And the Ger Rebbe was quite friendly with Rav Cook. So I understand why Richard Mayer Levin would invite her. Richard Mayer Levin wanted a big tent. So this is in the Tzvi Vot Yisrael, volume 2, pages 558 and on. So he writes to him very nicely, but he says that how can I participate with an organization which is, since its beginnings, has all been about Peirudim b'Yisrael, creating splits in Israel. And then he says, he elaborates on that, and then he says that the sages tell us that if you disgrace the Talmud Chacham, there's no refuah for your makkah. That's in Masechet Shabbat. He says, alachat kama v'kama, what the people associated with Aguda did to my father. He says, and again, this is not Itamar Levin's fault. He was in Europe when this was happening. This was going on in the 30s. He didn't come to Eretz Yisrael. He escaped during the war. But he says, "Ketzad itaken lishtatef v'tamalo azol she'oto gof tzibori?" He says, how can I, he's speaking in third person, he's saying, how can I participate with this organization? We won't even say the Aguda, oto gof tzibori, which in its name and with its flag publicly did the avodah hatmeya, the impure work for many years, l'katzer imei chayav she'adoni avi. They shortened, he's saying, Aguda shortened my father's life to put out the light of Orosh Olam Yisrael Varaita. And then he says, Aguda raised up children, Ne'arim, Noah Aguda Tisrael, who? Liyot Me'umanim B'mishak Ertzoch Nefesh and Adoni Avi Mori. To do this thing, remember, he's remembering this now, it's 22 years later, where they put my father on trial and executed him. And people were invited to see this. And this is what he says. Asharme Azad, Hina Loni Shmu. From then, 1932 until now, we have not heard from Mitzad Oto Guf Tziburi, from the Agudas Yisrael, from the office, the main thing. Afilu Shum Devei Chadar Avidu Azad. No apology. Nothing. He's speaking about the truth is that in Europe you did. All the local branches of Agudas Yisrael expressed themselves in the newspapers how outraged they were. But it is true that the national branch, the international Agudas Yisrael, they had this thing called Avada Poel, never condemned what happened there. And the reason they didn't condemn is because their attitude was they wanted to do it privately. They wrote private letters to Rav Sonnenfeld and their Moshe Blau in particular, that you have to stop this. It was Moshe Blau they wrote to. You have to stop this. They thought that the only way to solve this was quiet diplomacy. But this is a fact. Just, I'm sure the Democrats said the same thing about Ilhan Omar, which that was the issue. But the Republicans have this added problem also. It's not so simple to condemn people in your camp. But that is what Tzvi Yehuda Cook is referring to. And as I said, if the history of Agudas Yisrael is ever written, they will have to deal with this, that Agudas Yisrael was never able to condemn publicly what was going on in its name by its representatives in Eretz Yisrael. Now we get to Tzvi Yehuda's letter, which Rav Avinair is going to have to reply to, because if Rav Avinair says you have to respect all rabbis, even if they degrade your own rabbis, what does he do about this? So this is a letter. It relates to something Porush said against Rav Gorin. And he begins by saying that I was shocked to see the disgraceful things that this chatsuf, Porush, said. He says, according to the sages in Tractate Ta'anit, you're allowed to call him a Rasha and to hate him. If you look there, it says that people who degrade sages, you can do this too. And he says, Rashi says there, even though it says, Haftaracha kamocha, harezi yotzimei klal. Rashi says, explains that although we have to love all Jews, someone who degrades Torah sages, there's no obligation to love him in the country. You're supposed to hate him. It's these sorts of texts is the reason why I had to ask Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, what do we do with that? And Rav Aaron didn't give an answer. He simply said that today's day and age, everyone's going to be hating everyone. We can't do it. His attitude was the Rambam wouldn't say you have to do this today. It only applies in an era when no one's hate. When Jews basically get along and you have some heretic who's saying terrible things. But I don't know. And then he goes on to says, Asher biza barabim, that he disgraced my father and therefore Rizal Meltzer left the synagogue, and that he's the Netzig, he's the representative of Anshe HaGuda, HaYidua of the Aguda, who put out the light of the world. He shortened his life. Now, then he goes on, he moves to a different person. Rav Avinair doesn't get this. He thinks that the whole letter is about one person, Porush. It's not. It's about someone else. I sort of made, I could say I apologize, before in the 9 days to be speaking about this history, but it's part of Torah history as well. There's another person. Rav Avinair doesn't get it, and that's this person. Let's see. Moshe Blau on the left, the brother of Amram Blau, who was the head of the Aguda. On the right is Yitzhak Breuer, Dr. Yitzhak Breuer. They're testifying before the Anglo-American Committee on Israel, which met in America and also in London. They were in London. Moshe Blau was the political leader of the Aguda. And although in his book, he wrote a book about, like an autobiography, he refers to Rav Kook. He calls him Rav Kook, but he, and I think from my understanding of this time, he basically, he's not like his brother. His brother was a complete fanatic, and anyone who would agree with him is a heretic, Amram Blau. His brother becomes the head of the Jerry Karta. Moshe Blau dies in 1946 on the way to Israel for some Aguda business, also involved in rescue. He presided over the Aguda, which did all the terrible things to Rav Kook. Again, all these placards, there's a book that has all the placards, it's like five volumes. They were put up, some guy collected, he tore down and collected all these placards that are put up, and then he donated them to the Hebrew University, and they published a whole book of like five volumes. you don't think when you see these things that they're of any historical importance. They are of historical importance. Now we can write the history of the polemics against Rav Kook based on that. I even used one of them in my book, the last book, Changing the Immutables. So we have to be very thankful for the one guy who saved all these placards. And the people putting up these placards were members of the Aguda. They were members of the same shul. They all davened together, and they were never expelled, never anything like that. And don't judge someone until you're in their place. If I'm a member of that shul, we have people doing crazy things, maybe I would just say, well, it's not my business. But I guess Rav Tzvi Yehuda felt as a leader, he has to do something. So what does he say? He then starts speaking about Moshe Blau. He says, but in his journey, B'shlichus HaGuda, he says, Rav Kook said about him, about Moshe Blau, the one on the left, that the land would spit him out. The Zendit Kalem, and he says, this happened because he died in Chutz Aretz. He died, Moshe Blau on the left did not die in Israel. He died in Italy. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda refers to this as, he says he died, B'tzelo she'oto ha'ish ha'yadua. He says he died in the shadow of Oto ha'ish ha'yadua, of Jesus. In other words, you have to know what he's referring to, in Italy. Italy, Rome is the center of Catholicism. So he's saying that Rav Kook's curse came to fruition because Moshe Blau died. He died in Chutz Aretz. And then he goes on and says, Dino Shemavaza, if you the law of one who disgraces a Talmud Chacham is Borer or Muchat in the forest of Ocha Pesuka. He says it's clear in the Halacha. He says, look in the Shulchan Aruch, Reish Mem Gimel in Yeridea, that he's Menuda or Muchram, and he's put in Cherem, and there's a curse on him, Varehu Apikoras Muchat, and he's a complete heretic. And he goes on that the Hashem is careful about the tzaddik, kavod of tzaddiki, more than his own kavod. So here you have very harsh things from Tzvi Yehuda Kook said about Porush. Porush is not a gadol, but he's a rabbi. Blau was a rabbi. And attacking him in the most degrading way because he claims that both of them are heretics. Why are they heretics? Because they degraded Rav Kook. In the case of Moshe Blau, they are. We don't have anything per se written by Blau, but Blau allowed Rav Kook to be degraded. Don't forget, Dahan. You know who Dahan was? Israel Jacob Dahan, that's the first Jewish assassination. Part of his life was about degrading Rav Kook, and he was killed by the Zionists for a different reason, because he was trying to stop the creation of a state and had contacts with the Jordanians and the Saudis and everything, and he was a journalist, and he was able to propagandize against the Zionist dream. But he also was part and parcel of the machine to degrade the Rav Kook and the others. So I asked Rav Avinair, what's going on here? You're telling me to respect everyone. Are we really supposed to respect those who degrade Rav Kook? Look what Rav Tzvi Yehuda said about those two. Doesn't that apply to the others? So let me read you what Rav Avinair says. Rav Avinair published this letter, the two letters to me, in his Sefer Chai Yovel. He obviously thought it was important for other people to hear as well. He says, Shela Kasha Ma'ud. He says, this is a difficult question. And he says, on the one hand, there's the very harsh matter of disgracing a Talmud Chacham, Bizo Talmud Chacham. But on the other hand, if we allow everyone to be, if they degrade us and we degrade them, if we each start degrading each other, Chas V'Shalom, then the whole of Judaism will turn into a great fire. Because we're always going to find examples. You're going to degrade this person, and then they're going to degrade your person because you degraded him. There's not going to be an end to it. And then he says, we don't have a heter, therefore, to degrade any Talmud Chacham, even if he degrades another one. Even if he's supposed to be put in Chayrim. That is, a Talmud Chacham who degrades another Talmud Chacham should be put in Chayrim. But we can't degrade him, he says. And then he quotes the Rambam that a Talmud Chacham who you're supposed to put in Chayrim, the Beis Din doesn't go quickly on this. Take your time, because we don't want to put Talmud Chacham in Chayrim. And then he says what he says again. He says, yes, we have to protest, but this doesn't mean that we degrade them. And he quotes a Yerushalmi that says as well that if you degrade Talmud Chachamim, it basically destroys Judaism. And then he says, so then he goes on, Rav Tzvi Yehuda related with respect to Neturei Karta and Satmar. which I had, and it was, you have to know what Natrikarta means. There's different types of Natrikarta. There's like three branches of Natrikarta. If you live in America, you know the Natrikarta, this guy Beck, Moshe Ber Beck. I have a couple letters from him. I'm going to publish them one day. They're the ones who meet with the Iranians and who at the Israeli Day parades, they're the ones standing on the side there with the Palestinian flag and really road FEMA, maybe perhaps you could say, real disgraceful people. On the other hand, there's a different, the Natrikarta Israel, there's people who have nothing to do with that. There's the, they're not the pro-Palestinians. They don't, you know, have the flag. They just are opposed to the state of Israel. They're basically like Satmar types or the Nachasidim. I even have a sefer which they wrote attacking, because the guy in Muncie, Moshe Beck, in one of his books, he says that when Hamas succeeds in one of their terrorist actions to kill Jews, we are supposed to congratulate them on an action. And he quotes some Gemara. It's all about to save us, to save us. And the Natrikarta in Israel, their attitude is like, this is the craziest thing imaginable. They're like, we hate terrorists as much as the Zionists hate terrorists. And the terrorists kill us just like they kill the Zionists. So they have nothing to do. The Natrikarta, who I'm referring to in Israel, have nothing to do with the crazies who live in Muncie. Now, there are some crazies who live in Israel as well. But when Ratzia Yehuda speaks about the Natrikarta, he's speaking about Amram Blau, old-style Natrikarta. And he says he showed respect for them. He says certainly he protested and he fought against their mistaken views, but he respected them. And then he says, listen to this, Ratzia Yehuda, one time Ratzia Yehuda rebuked a student who said that the Jews were killed in the Holocaust because of Talmidei Chachamim who said not to go to Eretz Yisrael. And what did Ratzia Yehuda say to them? That's exactly what the Emah Banim Smecha says, or Betechtel. Ratzia Yehuda says, before you speak about Eretz Yisrael, learn Kavod Talmidei Chachamim. Learn to respect Torah sages. He's not saying that the guy is wrong. And Ratzia Yehuda, as a great Talmid Chacham himself, could have made that criticism. However, it's not for students to be criticizing great Torah scholars for mistakes they made. And then it says, once he went to a chasana, a wedding of someone in Satmar, and they respected him, they treated him, they gave him kavod. And he also respected them. And I've been around enough to know that sometimes the rhetoric doesn't translate into reality. People can say all sorts of things, but on a personal level, respect is given. Now he gets to what I pointed out to in the Sefer Hilchot Tzibur. He says, those strong matters that are quoted by in the name of Ratzia Yehuda and Rav Kook, it was a special case. Again, he's wrong. He doesn't realize that Ratzia Yehuda is speaking about two cases here. He's speaking about Porush and Blau, but he says it's a special case that this rabbi, Porush, mirror et chayim arav kol v'meshach kol chayav, embittered his life all his days until he shortened the life of Rav Kook, as it says there. See, he doesn't get it. It doesn't make any sense to say this about Porush. Because Porush was a young person there, and this happened in 32, and Rav Kook died in 35. And he's not, unless he's saying about Blau, and he's not referring to Porush. But the beginning of the thing deals with Porush. So I don't know. Maybe he's speaking about Blau. Maybe now I'm looking at it, I think he's not even speaking about Porush, he's speaking about Blau. And he says he organized him terrible things, and therefore a ruling went out that he's a chatsuf and a rasha, and you can't give him kavod. But this, he says, was a special ruling. But in general, he says, Anu tzirei atzon, we, the small people, we have to respect all the leaders, even if they make terrible mistakes and they disrespect sages, we have to respect them all, even though we protest. So basically, Rav Avner is saying, as a rule, we need to respect all Torah sages. Yes, the Gemara and the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch that say if you degrade a Torah sage, that you are to be degraded. You're not supposed to be martyred as a valid rabbi. That is not actionable, except in special individual cases where the great rabbi says that in this case you apply it. You wouldn't see this from the Rambam. In the Rambam, you'd assume that if someone degrades your Rebbe, you're supposed to assume that this person is no longer a valid rabbi anymore because he's been Mevazet Talmud Chacham. But we've seen now three tshuvot, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Ravenkin and Ravavina, they say the same thing, and two of them, the first two, Aaron Soloveitchik and Ravenkin, especially stress the fact, Ravavina also stresses it, that you can't do this. There'll be complete chaos, because I hate to say it, there are a lot of rabbis who spoke negatively about Rav Kook. So we're going to put all them in Cheirim, and then they're going to put all our rabbis in Cheirim. For putting them in Cheirim, it's going to be like the dispute over the Rambam's works in France, where the rabbis in southern France put the rabbis in northern France in Cheirim, and they put the rabbis in southern France in Cheirim, and that doesn't really get you anywhere. And that's, I have to say, I think that's it's a good approach. It's a good way. And as Rav Henkin says at the end of his tshuva, it's better to be the one who is degraded than the one who degrades. And I can tell you that Rav Soloveitchik had this approach as well. The story was told by Dr. Lavovitz, who was a macher in Boston in the Maimonides school, that he once was coming to the Rav's house, and coming out of the house was one of these Eda Haredi people, who they come to Israel, they might've come to your house to collect money. And he didn't want to give, obviously, you know, give to these people. And the guy showed Lavovitz that the Rav had given him money. So Lavovitz went into the Rav's house, and very upset. How can you give money to them? He said to the Rav, and this is Lavovitz told the story. You know that if you ever go to Israel, you know who's going to be at the airport holding signs saying Soloveitchik, go home? It's those people. And the Rav smiled and said, and again, this is the exact words that Lavovitz said. The Rav smiled and said, yes, but he promised me that he wouldn't use my donation to buy signs. So the Rav's attitude was like, you know, they were coming to support poor widows and orphans. You can do that. And we know that Rav Kook, there's a number of cases, there are stories of people, they needed Rav Kook's help because Rav Kook had access to the High Commissioner and other things, and they're going abroad, they needed to raise money for all sorts of reasons. But these were people in the Aguda circles who had degraded Rav Kook, but they had to lower themselves to go to Rav Kook to ask him for a letter of introduction. And Rav Kook again and again would do that. Ramosha Feinstein did things like that for crazies who attacked him. We do see that the great Torah scholars are able to put this aside, and even people who did bad things to them, they seem to be able to, and I'm not saying these people came and asked them for forgiveness before they, no, they don't ask for forgiveness. They come and ask for the help without asking for forgiveness. And yet we see that they do put this aside, and basically, you're a healthier person if you're not attacking the others. And it, as Rav Kook said, that Ma'at or Dochar Bechoshech, and the Beis Hamikdash is destroyed because of Sinat Chinam, needless hatred. Rav Kook says it's going to be rebuilt because of Avas Chinam, needless love. What is needless love? According to Halacha, you don't need to love those people. According to Strict Halacha, they said terrible things about great rabbis and other things. You don't need to love them. Rav Kook says you still should love them, even if technically you don't have to. That's avat chinam. I just think it's a better way to live. And I know my Satmar friends agree with me when I say that, you know, you grow up in that community, the chinuch is just a terrible chinuch. The whole chinuch. And they hate it. They tell me how much they hate it. It's all about this heretic and that heretic, and you have to hate this one and oppose this one. And what type of education is that? How you raise people with such negativity, and that's a terrible thing. And unfortunately, there are groups that are raised, which they try to reason like this, and it works. But the people I know in those communities, they've been able to emancipate themselves from that. But and they're still in the community. But it doesn't change the fact that you look in the literature, it's all about hatred of this person, hatred of that person. Pick up a Satmar newspaper each week. It's always about another apikoros, another this. And of course, then they turn on themselves. When you're done hating the outsiders, then you turn on yourselves and you kill this Satmar and that Satmar. So I think it's an important lesson that we don't want to fall into that trap, despite what the halacha would seem to say, that and it's never been activated, really, this halacha. You look at the Emden Eibshitz disputes, that means Rav Yaakov Emden said his thing and Yosef Eibshitz said his. But they didn't then all fall into line with Europe being split, each one regarding heretics. Most people had it just ignored it. You can go down the list of disputes between great rabbis, and basically it remained disputes between the rabbis. Very rarely do the individuals get involved with this, and that's perhaps the way it should be. Okay, we spent a lot of time just on one tshuva, but it's an important one. I think it's one of the most important ones in the volume, or the whole theme of how to relate to, especially if you come from the religious Zionist world, where this is now 100 years, you're being degraded by Torah scholars. What are you supposed to do? When we pick up next week, we have, I'll get to the comments in a second, all sorts of great stuff. Schechter on the Rav, conversion stuff, good stuff. Take my word for it, lots of good stuff. And maybe next time, I'll even get to, it's not going to be next week. I'll speak to Rabbi Kelman. I'll be away next week. So I'll speak to him if we want to do it Sunday night, or we'll do it, we'll just skip a week. We have lots of good stuff coming on. Oh, and then we're going to get to issues of the Rambam and superstition. Most of our communities is superstitions are rampant. We'll get to that. Oh, and another one from Menashe Klein that takes us back to Brandeis University. So I will take the questions and comments now. I hope people found it of interest. Baruch points out that the prayers we're seeing are not in a formal house of worship. Very important point. Yes, that is an important point. It's not in a church, of course, and it's not in a synagogue either. But it's important, perhaps, I know it's important for Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Lau and the others. They wouldn't bring it into the synagogue. But it's not important for the Rav. It's not important for the American scene. The idea, it's still very jarring. Show it to your local rabbi. Rabbis and priests and an imam and a druze all saying a prayer together. The Rav was so opposed to an interfaith chapel. Kal v'chomer, actually interfaith prayer. And Rabbi Kelman says even praying their own prayer is more radical. As the chief rabbi stands, like some praying Jesus. You could say that, except the difference is they're private. They're saying silently. But you're right. And if you look at the website I pulled up, the Catholic leader says he did the Lord's Prayer. That's to Jesus. So here you're praying together silently. Maybe that is worse. Yes, Baruch says the Allgemeine was edited by Gershon Jacobson of Crown Heights. I'm not sure when. Sometime in the 80s, they put an English section in. I believe that Manfred Lehman owned the English section, or he had a stake in it. I know he had a stake in it. He might have owned it. But the English section became quite interesting. They even once did a thing on me because there was a guy from Washington Heights. He wrote a review of my book on Rabbi Weinberg. It was like the only really bad review. It wasn't a bad review per se, as he dealt with Ray Weinberg as just an insignificant person. He was reflecting the disputes in Germany between the separatists and Rabbi Weinberg, who's not from the separatists. And then I got to reply, and it was interesting in the newspaper. Easter Sunday, Rav David and Rav Ruvain were at the Levaya and then Shloshim. No, Rav David and Rav Ruvain were not at the Levaya. I was at the Levaya. They were not there. They were at the Shloshim in YU. You're saying Rav Malkiel Cutler was at Newark Airport and was told to go home. Apparently he got a call from the Rosh Hashiva in Philadelphia. This all went back to the Rosh Hashiva in Philadelphia saying that they have to boycott it. It was very hard for Malkiel Cutler because the Rav was very close to the Cutlers, close to Rav Aaron, close to Rav Schneer. When Rav Schneer passed away, the Rav Soloveitchik paid a shiva call to Rav Malkiel, and he said to him, I was your, in these words, I was your grandfather's friend, I was your father's friend, and now I'll be your friend. And but I guess Rav Malkiel was a young man, and he's told he has to listen to the Das Torah. The Jewish Observer article is posted on the online main site website. Well, the Jewish Observer article is posted on the what I showed you. Someone in Rabbi Tendler's piece, which was published in the Allgemeiner, they included the Jewish Observer piece in the middle of it. At the time, I remember feeling bad for the Jewish Observer because I didn't know what they would do. I didn't know about the Rav Shach's order, but they can't exactly come out and say Rav Soloveitchik's the great Rosh Yeshiva and all that, because that would defeat their whole purpose in their minds. They had of saying that, you know, then why shouldn't you then go listen to Rav Soloveitchik? In their minds, if you don't accept their Das Torah, you could be a Talmid Chacham, but you can't be a gadol or a communal leader or anything like that. That's their issues. Barry says, was Torah Rav Avram Palm called Rav Menachem Danak and apologized for the distasteful article in the Jewish Observer and asked Mechila from Talmidim of the Rav? This is, it's more complicated even than that, because shortly before the Rav passed away, a couple of years, a bunch of YU guys, Jeffrey Wolf and others, they published this volume in honor of the Rav. I forgot what it's called, Odorov, something like that. And it had letters from Rosh Yeshiva, Ramosha, for instance. But Ramosha already, in the Haredi world, they knew Ramosha's not reliable, because Ramosha was already compromised by his relationship with the Rav and also with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. But you even had Rav Gifter has an article in there. Rav Shach has another Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Shach has a letter in which he condemns the publication of this volume and criticizes how could these Rosh Yeshiva contribute to a volume in honor of Rav Soloveitchik. So the Rosh Yeshiva in America, even if they didn't, Rav Nachum Kamenetsky and others, even if they didn't agree with YU, they thought very highly of the Rav. Rav Ruderman was very close to the Rav. I don't think Rav Shach got it living in Israel. Oh, Menachem Butler posted an iconic photo of the funeral here. Please send that to me, David, because when we close out, I'm not on it. The funeral was in Maimonides, only the special people, old-time Boston people, Kos Talmidim of the Rav, old rabbis, etc., were able to get into the shul. The rest of us, they set it up in another like auditorium, a video feed, and the only person who spoke was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. And at the time, there was great dispute going on between in the Soloveitchik family, and he called for peace. I don't know if that's in the transcript, but you can hear on the website. He said, "Now is the time to put away machlokas in the family." Just Rav Aaron spoke. It's a very interesting hesped on the Rav. And then they sat Shiva, Rav Aaron sat Shiva together with the Tversky's. That is, I mean, the Lichtenstein sat with the Tversky's, and both Rav Lichtenstein and Professor Tversky tore Kriya. They regarded the Rav as their Rebbe. And I went to the Shiva house once. I wouldn't have gone just for the sake of going, because I was in the Rav's shir the last year, and I knew Professor Tversky, obviously. Actually, let me take that back. I probably would have gone just for Professor Tversky, because he was sitting Shiva. He wasn't really sitting on the floor. He was sitting like a quasi-Shiva. But I was given, in those days, that was before email, you had faxes. So all these faxes had come in to Professor Tversky, condolences. So I was at, in Cambridge, I was at Harvard, and the Center for Jewish Studies gave me a huge stack. And they asked me, could I take it over to the house? So I brought it to the house. All the stacks, the letters just coming in, you know, to the family. And Rav Aaron was there, sitting on the floor, and the two sisters were there. Chaim, for reasons, if you know the families, was sitting somewhere else. Then he went back to New York. David Lukens was there when I was there. David Lukens was quite close to the Rav, and that was I could tell more later about also another time. Baruch says, Zal is higher than Zatzal. Well, today it's not. Today it's not. In the past, Hillel doesn't need Gadol Mirabban Shemot. Hillel doesn't even have a title. But today you give Zatzal, and you don't just give. You don't just say Harav Zal. You say Hagon, Harav, this. In Rav Shach's letter, in which he criticizes Rav Soloveitchik's Zionist writings, he puts Aleph Hey, Aleph HaShalom. Oh, Shalom is even below Zal. Kay Shiner, Shach's attack on Soloveitchik was about his view against Das Torah. No, it wasn't against Das Torah per se. It was his famous drasha, in which he explains why he rejects his family tradition and becomes a Zionist. And I guess that is against Das Torah, but he doesn't mention Das Torah. He mentions really the words Das Torah. It's all about how he's breaking with Mesorah. I guess that's Das Torah, but that's what it was. But it focuses on his defense of Zionism. Barry says, Dr. Belkin asked his son, Ephraim Shach, to ask his father to be Rosh Yeshiva. He refused. Yeah, but Rosh Shach had been in Yishuv HaChadash. He had already been at a... it wasn't a Hezri yeshiva. It was a Zionist yeshiva. They didn't have Hezri yeshivas in those days. It was originally a yeshiva. It was established, at least I don't think it was a Hezri yeshiva. It was a yeshiva at Hadaron. It was founded by Rav Ischa Zalman Meltzer's son-in-law. And it was a Zionist sort of yeshiva. But then Briskerov told him to leave. Yeah, it's true that the Rav's position is censored. Yeah. Harav HaGaon HaGadol. The way they distinguish it now is Harav HaGaon is not the big title. If you see someone Harav HaGaon, everyone gets Harav HaGaon. Even I get it in this book. HaGaon Harav is the title, is the better one. But if you want to move beyond that, there's Maran, there's HaGaon Amiti, etc., etc. Gavad is Gaon HaBeis. Yeah. Let's see, just a few more things. Shmuel says he thinks it was Sira Yagudisro who quipped, Losasura Haravavcha Vachrenechem, not Herzl, not Cook. It could have been that Sira Yagudisro was, they were the troublemakers and they were carrying on constantly. And when you know who was not in their camp, all the people today that the Haredi looks to, Rav Yashin, Rav Shmuel Zalmarbach, Tugachinsky, none of them were in their camp. It was the Hungarians and the Prushim. And there's no problem with the people like Rav Zonnenfeld and his Beis Din, other than the fact that they did not feel it was important to do what needed to be done to stop them for the reasons we spoke about. And they couldn't have stopped them anyway. Had Rav Zonnenfeld turned against them, then they would have turned against Rav Zonnenfeld. The Ger Rebbe was fine until the Ger Rebbe came to meet with Rav Kook. And then the Ger Rebbe, they put out placards against him. So these were crazy people. Yes, Rav Nachum Porsche's son Meir is a current MP from Aguda. I believe him. You know what? My attitude is I don't really care what Nachum Porsche did. He, if he shot Rav Kook, he was a kid. He was, how old was he? I'll tell you how old he was right now. Not that it was a good thing, obviously. It's a terrible thing, but he's born in 1916. So that would have made him 16 years old. The rest of his life, he didn't live like this. He showed respect, other than Rav Gorin, that was a different issue. He showed respect for the chief rabbis, assuming that he did pull the trigger or not. He clearly regretted what he did. I don't think we can start judging people their entire life. He was an Aguda member in good standing. There never were any scandals about him. He didn't steal any money, anything like that. He represented Aguda with dignity. He used to come to America. He spoke English. He represented them with dignity. He is someone to look up to, and he's not the only one who in his youth did a terrible thing, and he didn't do what his other family, other members of his family did. When the Great Break came, he went with the Aguda, and he accepted the state. He didn't join the Eda Haredit. And his son is a very good man, I'm told, as well. One of the chief fanatics, Michael says, Yaakov Dahan, who had been a Zionist, was considered such a threat that he was assassinated in 1924 with the agreement of the Yishuv. That is correct. A lot of people don't know this. They say it's the first Jewish assassination. For a long time, we didn't know who assassinated him. Then it came out in the 1980s, mid-1980s. They even did an Israeli television did a thing on him. This guy was living in Hong Kong, a former Haganah member who spilled the beans that he was the one who did the assassination. It was ordered by Ben Tzvi. If you go online in Wikipedia, you can find all the details. Dahan, are you going to say this is acceptable halachically, morally, assassination? From the standpoint of the Zionists, Dahan, who had come, he is a Baal Tshuva. He had been intermarried. He is a Baal Tshuva, and he becomes a religious fanatic. He apparently also kept up on the side his homosexual relations, and he was involved in all sorts of stuff. But he was really the leader of the Eda Haredit, and he was pushing to create an Arab control, and they thought that he could be the end of the Zionist dream. So was that legitimate to kill someone for that? It's hard for me to think so, but that is true. Someone emails me private, texts me privately, that prior to Rav Israel Rosen's statement about Rebelach, which was first said, incidentally, by Rav Avram Shapiro, Rav Lichtenstein was forced to respond to the statements of a member of his kollel who had made statements prior to the Rabin assassination. And Rav Lichtenstein acknowledged that the person who said this is a Talmud Chacham, but he referred to him as a technocrat of Halacha who was unqualified to render decisions on public matters, which is true. Just because you're a rabbi, just because you're a posek, doesn't you can decide if this is muktzah. It doesn't mean if you can make decisions. So Paul says he heard that Dahan was killed because he was a pedophile and continued to abuse underage boys. There was a theory that he was killed by Arabs because of that, but now we know that's not the case, that he was killed by the Haganah to get him out of the way. He was killed coming out of Mincha. And there's no question he was involved with all these homosexual relations, and yet he was Sonnenfeld's right-hand man. In the Haredi world, in the Eda Haredi world, they don't believe this. They think he's a Kadosh, a Tahar in all ways. The enlightened ones know the truth, and they think that, well, he's a man, he had this unfortunate sideline, but they think he's a sinner like others. But in their literature, they don't say this at all. And if someone wants to justify how you can kill someone because you don't like their politics, let me hear it, because it does seem to be an act of ritzicha. Kay Shiner, Moshe Blau was the father-in-law of Schlesinger of London, one of the most extreme Rosh Yeshiva, who speaks of Satmar and Turin character events. Yes, and he's a Talmud Mufak of the Brisker Rav, this Eliyakim Schlesinger. He's not a he's not Satmar, but he's involved with them. He's in his mid-90s now. I won't turn my head. All the things I said about the Han, people know about that now. Yes, we have poetry from him, where Dahan. You can read all about Dahan. When is the book on Rav Kook coming out? The book on Rav Kook was completed the last week, but I still need to review it, read it over, and then I need to send it to two people. There's two people I want to send it to, Betzalel Naor and Ari Shvat, if you know Ari Shvat from Israel, real experts on Rav Kook, so they'll spare me from any, hopefully from any errors I make, and I don't think they're going to agree with everything I say, but that's okay. Yes, and as Sulzbach points out, he wasn't a pedophile. He was, Michael says, he was a threat to the Zionist enterprise. That's right. That's all correct. You all know what I'm saying. Almost done. A couple more. Kay Shiner, the person whom the Rav gave money to was Yossel Scheinberger, whose grandson, Yehuda Meshizah, founder of Zaka, became a religious Zionist, so the Rav's investment paid off. Okay, I didn't know that was the one he gave it to. If you don't know who this Yehuda Meshizah is, you have to. Yehuda Meshizah was a spokesman for the Eda Haredit, and then it's incredible. Something happened. He changed his view. He came to understand that we're all one people, and he's very much involved now in the organized state, this organization, Zaka, which helps after terrorist attacks and other things. Very interesting. So Mel says, Refreshal Shachter is on at 9 p.m. on Sunday night. Well, I don't know if that's not a reason to come. It just means that if we do it, you can watch it on YouTube. But I don't know. Well, Rav Ruderman, fine. One last thing. Rav Ruderman was very close to the Rav. Please elaborate. The Rav had, his Gabayim said, the Rav had two people who we would make sure to call before Yom Tov always. That was Rav Ruderman and Rav Moshe. I'm not sure where the connection to Rav Ruderman came from. Perhaps Rav Ruderman, if you know the history, he sort of was kept out of the Agudas Yisrael of having any power. Rav Aaron was very, Cutler was very opposed to the whole system of Ner Yisrael. And could have been the reason why he found this connection. I don't know of any pictures of the Rav with Rav Ruderman. All I know is that they would speak on the phone, and they had some, I don't even know how often they met, but they had this connection, at least on the phone. But the Rav said about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he hadn't seen the Lubavitcher Rebbe in like 30 years. He said, with some people you're friends with, you don't need to see them. Before he went to the famous Firm Brangen, I think he hadn't seen him since Berlin, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe saw him in the 40s. In the early 40s, you have a picture of them. The Rav is sitting at a table together with the Friedrich Rebbe and Rav Menachem Mendel. So I don't know the connection to, you'd have to ask. He has sons-in-law and children. You can ask Rav Ruderman. I just know that they always would have a phone call to Rav Moshe and Rav Ruderman, and there was a lot of respect. Rav Ruderman came to America because of Rav Meir Bar Ilan. Rav Ruderman went to see the Kovno Rav, and the Kovno Rav was meeting with Rav Bar Ilan, and Rav Ruderman had an invitation to come to America, but he wanted to go there to Yisrael, and it was Meir Bar Ilan, the Mizrahi leader, who said that America, who had been in America, he had spent a good deal of time in America, he said, America needs rabbis. If you can go there and be successful, go there. And in its early years, Ner Yisrael could have been mistaken for Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Chanan and its approach to Zionism and other things. There's a great video I have. I can send it to anyone. You can see it online as well. they interviewed Rav Ruderman a couple of years before he passed away, and they asked him all these things. And when you listen to him, he's like an old Litvak. He's telling you like it was in Lithuania, and you see he's not in with the new Frumkeit. And the guys are not really clear at what he's saying, so they can't believe some of the things he's saying. But anyone who had any experience with an old-time Rosh Hashiva Litvak, you know that sometimes they couldn't get on board with a lot of the things happening. Oh, and Shiner says that Rabbi Ruderman's son-in-law, Rabbi Weinberg, wrote an article in the Sefer in honor of Rav Soloveitchik. There's always been connections between the more right-wing YU Rebbes would often send their kids to learn in Eretz Yisrael. So I don't know if they do today. Today it's a very different place. But there always was these connections between Eretz Yisrael and the rabbis at YU. There was back and forth. Eretz Yisrael never apostled YU. And they never apostled the YU Rosh Yeshiva. And they never apostled the Rav. There's a tape also of Rabbi Weinberg speaking about Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Yaakov Weinberg. Rav Yaakov Weinberg, of course, is not Rav Soloveitchik's level. Rav Soloveitchik doesn't need his haskama, but he is a very original thinker, an interesting person, and he speaks very highly, interestingly, of Rav Soloveitchik. He says something which I thought was disrespectful, though, but it's true, I guess. But he says that, Rabbi Weinberg says that Rav Soloveitchik would rip Kriya if he heard this, but he says that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the Rav's father, was never at the level of the Rav. So Rav Moshe would agree with this, that the Rav, his son, was greater than him. But I don't think you can say that. Of course, the Rav wouldn't agree with it, but Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, in speaking about them, says that Rav Moshe the Rav was able to surpass his father, which of course is the dream of all of us, that our children surpass us. And if you read what Rav Moshe writes, how he describes his son, you know that he thought his son was greater than him. But for the Rav, of course, his father was the greatest, other than his grandfather. In fact, the story, as I'll end with this, that who told the story? I forgot which. It's in a few different places. I forget who asked the question, though, when Rav Moshe was speaking about how great his son was. He's the greatest gadol and this and that. So someone asked him, we have a lot of learned people, or someone's going to know who asked him the question. So the person who was with him said, I think it might have been Shurin, said to him, this is Yaakov Kamenetsky's son-in-law, said, is he greater than the Rav? I mean, than Rav Chaim? And Rav Moshe said, no one is greater than the Tati, than the father. But after Rav Chaim, Rav Moshe thought that his son was greater than all these other rabbis in America, even though they were 50 years older than him. Okay, thank you all very much. If someone, Shurin wrote about the Rav and he had a connection to the family. This is Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's son-in-law. Thank you all very much. I will not see you, at least not next Monday. Torah in Motion will send out an email if we're skipping or what it is. Other than that, till we meet again. When we meet again, we'll get back into halacha. Some more halachic issues, conversion, etc. So here, this, I took you back in a little bit of history. Okay, Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay, tomorrow morning, Dr. Josh Berman on Megillat Eicha as we continue our Tanakh series, a little out of order. As if you haven't been coming, I encourage you to come. Every class is, of course, every day is a different book, a different teacher. So everyone is independent of the others. You can listen to the past ones on the website. Thursday, of course, we're having our all-day Tisha B'Av program. It's the same link as this, as the Monday night class. It's the same link on Tisha B'Av. So you don't have to re-register for that. But that's from 12 to 7 on Tisha B'Av. And another expert on Rav Kook, Yehuda Mirsky, kicking off this.
Let me just say one thing also, unless you have something to say. Shiner tells us that Rav Nutta Greenblatt, he heard from Rav Nutta Greenblatt of Memphis, an old Talmud of Moshe Soloveitchik. He was there when his father asked for most of the questions. So that's where it comes from. Rav Nutta Greenblatt heard his father. The Rav is great, but not as great as a Rav Chaim.
Listen, you know, on the Rav Smicha, the Dvar Avram, that's the famous story. The Dvar Avram gave the Rav Smicha in the 1920s, said the Rav was, 26 years old. He said, if all the rabbis in the world say A and Rav Soloveitchik says B, you do B.
Halacha kamosa b'chol makom, it says.
Right. So it wasn't only his father who sang the praises of his son. The Rav was Yachid b'mino.
By the way, I'll tell you something more. that in the book on Rebbeir Soloveitchik from Israel, the Brisker, the son of Avelvel, which has all this extreme stuff, he says that we all know, that is, he's speaking from one of the Jerusalem Briskers, that Rav Yosha Ber is the greatest of all of us. He's not referring to his father, he's saying in the next generation, and that if only his hashkafas would be in line with the proper hashkafas, then we all would like fall in line behind him. But they acknowledge that Rav Soloveitchik is greater in learning than any of them, which is, I found, really interesting.